right, so we are the last day of Perek Chaf Hei. We'll discuss somewhat more hashkafa than direct musar today. This is something that I came across a couple of years ago and like worked out we're going to do a whole shiur on this, and I think we gave a whole shiur on this topic. About four-fifths of the way done through being completed, I came across an article by someone named Yaakov Weinstein, who apparently lives in East Brunswick, New Jersey, who wrote an entire article on everything that I was talking about and had everything in it. So it was within the Hakira Journal of 2012, an article entitled "The Biblical View of Slavery Then and Now in Commemoration of the 150th Anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation." So over the course of this Perek Chaf Hei, so it discusses both Eved Ivris as well as Eved Kenanis, both Jewish slaves as well as non-Jewish slaves, and what do we view about that? Is that like a good thing for the Jews or a bad thing for the Jews? How do we recognize the idea of slavery within the morality of Torah? So this past Shabbos between Mincha and Marv, in a shir in the congregation of Beth HaMedrash, so the rabbi over there discussed the issue of morality and morality in Torah, and some things that are challenging, right? The mitzvah of destroying a malik and the mitzvah of the ir nidachas, the issue of mamzeris. So we didn't get to the rabbi didn't get to mamzeris, but
no, he didn't.
But those
the second page.
So those issues are. Hey, you have keys for me? Are you going home?
Yeah.
And sure. Alright, tell mommy to text me if you get Shua.
Say hello to Eli on your board.
Yes, he's still playing. He'll be leading a powerful, giant offensive attack this upcoming year. So there is a statement of the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish has in the beginning of Emunah V'Bitachon, he says, well, the Torah defines morality. There's no ifs, ands, or about it. At least that's, he gives an example there, as we discussed the issue of Hasagas Kvul, that a new Rebbe shows up in town, so the old Rebbe aren't happy that the new Rebbe is showing up, and they lead to a fight, so who's right? Well, the Torah demands that the new Rabbi is right. Their Kina Sofrim Tar B'Chachma is an important principle, that the challenging of Tamidi Chachamim will lead to greater wisdom is the principle that holds sway, and therefore the old rabbis that are complaining about the new rabbis are wrong, and they're morally wrong. So halacha defines morality, that's the words of Chazon Ish. Now, does he leave it there? How far does the Chazon Ish go? I'm not sure. I bet you there's probably some interesting work that a person could do with regards to that, but not everybody's necessarily bound to that position of the Chazon Ish. Does the fact that the Torah seems to say that slavery is okay, not just okay, but it seems like there's many halachos about it, and it seems like it's part of the regular society, does that mean that we should be seeking to re-implement the laws of Avdus, the laws of slavery, in the year 2018? I mean, halavai, we should have a king of Israel, and halavai, we should build the base of Migdash, and halavai, we should go back to a system where Jews own other Jews and can direct them to do various things at their will, even though there are tremendous responsibilities along with owning a slave. But is that good or is that bad? So this came to a head. I'm not sure there's discussion coming earlier, but I came across this also when studying the same period of time. He starts the date as being December 14th, 1860. What was December 14th, 1860? So December 14th, 1860, who was the president in 1860? That was the trick question. You fell for it. Who was the president in 1860?
James Buchanan.
Very good. James Buchanan. James Buchanan was the president in 1860. And in December 14th, 1860, he declared that January 4th, 1861, would be a day of humiliation, fasting, and prayer. Now, it was January 4th, 1861. Is that 2 weeks before the inauguration of Abraham Lincoln?
No. They were in March.
Correct. It was about going to be 2 months before the inauguration of Abraham Lincoln. James Buchanan is haplessly trying to control the various factions of the American country, trying to keep it together, and he declares this day as being a day of humiliation, fasting, and prayer. The proclamation says, let us look deep, contrition, and penitent, and sorrow, unite in humbling ourselves before the Most High, in confessing our individual national sins, and in acknowledging the injustice of our punishment, let us implore Him to remove from our hearts the false pride of opinion which would impel us to persevere in wrong and forsake consistency, rather than yield a just submission to an unforeseen exegesis in which we are now surrounded. Let us with deep reverence beseech Him to restore the friendship and goodwill which prevailed in former days amongst the people of the several states, and above all, to save us from the horrors of civil war and blood guiltiness. Let our fervent prayers ascend. Yada, 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 yada. So this
Was Buchanan at that point a religious person?
I don't know. It doesn't mean... probably. I mean, everyone was religious then.
Like,
yeah, everyone was religious then. James Buchanan actually has a unique... besides him being the only president to ever be named Buchanan, he has... What was his unique feature?
You know, they're not going to kill you for all this. He would...
I know the answer. I'm letting you participate, yes?
He was a bachelor.
He was a bachelor, yes.
The only bachelor ever.
Like,
he also gets a very bad president.
He was from Lancaster?
One of the worst presidents.
Buchanan House is...
Maybe he's ahead of Warren Harding.
I thought it was James Monroe's house. I thought it was the Monroe's house. They're both from Lancaster?
I thought it was Buchanan.
I believe James Monroe is from near the Shul in Lancaster.
35 years earlier. No, Monroe has nothing to do with this.
No, I understand, but he raised that he's from Lancaster. I think it's James Monroe that was from Lancaster. Do you...
No, believe it or not, you find these...
That's a piece of presidential history that you're...
Well, yeah, I know... lacking. They are both from Pennsylvania, though. I don't know.
Okay. All right, anyways, so he was he declared that, and that was taken seriously, meaning a day when the president declares a day of... again, what do you call it? A day of humiliation, fasting, and prayer. So that means everybody's going to take it seriously. So everybody goes to their respective house of worships, and the various pastors, priests, rabbis gave sermons about the day. So one can go back, and everybody knew the pressing issue at the time was slavery. Are we for slavery or against slavery? So you could actually go back and find those sermons. Be interesting to see what rabbis have to say about slavery. Now, first of all, should we care? We're just somebody who called himself rabbi in America in 1860. Were there Orthodox rabbis in America? So the answer is yes. Not too many. There weren't even too many Jews in America. There weren't too many people in America, we think about. But there were several rabbis who came to America in the early 1800s, and actually there was pretty much one or two Orthodox synagogues in the main cities. So Philadelphia, Mikveh Israel existed then already. Spanish and Portuguese synagogue existed already. There's already a breakaway from Spanish and Portuguese in New York that existed already. There was a synagogue in Savannah. There was a synagogue in Charleston. There was a synagogue in Baltimore. There was a synagogue in Rhode Island. Yes. I would assume there would be one in Boston also. I'm not sure what other history. But there certainly were rabbis around. And now... The idea of reform rabbinate already existed. Not so much in America. I shouldn't say that. The issue of reform was already in the early 1800s. But it wasn't like the split, although in Europe there was obviously a massive split. In America it wasn't as clear the distinctions between reform and what we consider traditional Torah Judaism. Conservative Judaism did not yet exist. That it doesn't exist till the end of the 1800s. Okay, so there was a rabbi named Rabbi Bernard Illoway. Rabbi Bernard Illoway, I've mentioned a few times the congregation of Beth Hamedrash. There actually is a book available on HebrewBooks.com that was put together by his descendants in English, where they tell stories, they list, they quote various articles of his, they put together various speeches of him. There's actually a couple pages of Piskei Halacha that he gave. He was clearly an Orthodox rabbi. He was a Talmud of the Chasam Sofer. He was a Talmud of the Chasam Sofer and came to America to be a Orthodox rabbi, and did the best he can in America in various cities, where he was. One of those cities where he happened to be the rabbi in 1860 was Baltimore, Maryland. Now, Baltimore, Maryland, was that a slave state or was that a free state? Was that a north or the south?
Well, it was a free state, but maybe not so much. It was probably a split
state. What?
Slavery.
It was, right, it was in theory a slave state, but stayed with the North. right? They stayed with the North, so the Emancipation Proclamation didn't apply to Maryland. Because remember, the Emancipation Proclamation was freeing all slaves in the rebelling states, and Maryland was not. That doesn't mean that there wasn't a big challenge in Baltimore. In fact, the first killing of the Civil War was actually riots that took place in Baltimore, besieged abolitionists and pro-slavery sides, so which took place, I believe, after the speech. So Rabbi Bernard Illaway was the rabbi at that time of the Lloyd Street Synagogue, I believe. Lloyd Street Synagogue would be known to... where is Eitan the rabbi?
I'm trying to think. I don't know.
So the Lloyd, I believe the Lloyd Street Synagogue is the building next to the building where Eitan Mintz is the rabbi right now. You can go to it today. It is currently a museum. I went to it a couple of years ago. It's really amazing. I found it very inspiring to go. It was Orthodox at the time the Rabbi Illaway was there. It became Reform, switched back, going back and forth, and then there was an Orthodox synagogue that got built next door, which still exists today, and Eitan Mintz is the rabbi. It's about four blocks away from the Inner Harbor in Baltimore. If you go to Baltimore, the ESPN zone, if that still exists there. Right? So about a couple blocks in, there are these two synagogues right next to each other. They're almost mirror image of each other. One of them is still operating as an Orthodox synagogue, and the other one has become a museum. You can go to the basement. There is actually a mikvah in the basement. The oldest, I believe it is the oldest known, or the third, I think the third oldest known mikveh in America is in the basement of that. What?
This is Maryland.
This is in Maryland. I don't know what, in terms of mikvahs that were built, I don't know. This is newer than Rhode Island, but I'm not sure the mikveh, I don't know what there was in Rhode Island. But anyways, so this brings us to Rabbi Illaway. So Rabbi Illaway says, I'm not so comfortable with the idea of slavery, but we see much things about slavery in the Torah. And he goes through the examples, A, that there's halachos regarding slavery, and B, not only are there halachos regarding slavery, but we see that there are some pretty important Jews that own slaves. Namely, which Jews in the Torah own slaves? I'm not sure you'd call them Jews.
Abraham.
Yes, right. That Avram, I'm unclear about Yitzhak and Yaakov. Yitzhak also, but they owned the Avadim. That certainly Avram owned the Avadim. So how can you say? So he writes. He says, and it was also written in those days. All the sermons were then written out, and they were actually distributed in pamphlet form. If you go to the Yad Lam, where every Lam's sermons are all put on the internet, so about half of them are his notes, like his personal typeset notes, and half of them are these pamphlets that were distributed by the Jewish center, that they would write up a sermon and give them out for people. So, anyways. So, no right to exercise violence against institutions of... all these are a few proofs that we have no right to exercise violence against institutions of other states or countries, even if religious feelings and philanthropic sentiments bid us to disapprove of them. It proves furthermore that the authors of the many dangers which threaten our country with ruin and devastation are not what they pretend to be, the agents of religion and philanthropy. Therefore, my friends, there is only one rampart which can save our country from degradation and ruin and shield it against all the danger arising from and threatening from without. This is the goodwill, the good sense, the feelings of the great mass of the people. They must have no other guides than the Book of God and virtues which it teaches, and make their hearts inaccessible to the pernicious influence of some individual who exert all the efforts to mislead them under the guise of religion and philanthropy from the true path of true religion. What is the true path of true religion? To allow slavery. To allow slavery. Now, that got him into a little bit of trouble in Baltimore.
It's quite different than the enforced slavery in America.
Hold on. So that is what Rabbi Illaway taught. This got him into some amount of trouble with the in Baltimore, and he actually left Baltimore and became the rabbi of the largest city in the southern in the Confederacy. What is the largest city in the Confederacy? New Orleans. Yes, he became the Rav of New Orleans, and he has a very interesting psak, one of the Piskei Halachos when he was the Rabbi in New Orleans, that he paskined in Naguna Shaila. And he paskined in Naguna Shaila Lahachmir. He paskined in Naguna Shaila, so one of his members died in a, well, he doesn't know if they died. Assumed they seemed, probably died in a boating, in a ship in a shipwreck, in a sinking ship, that they didn't have clear proof, and he passed, and then his wife was in a guna. His wife couldn't remarry off of that. He was, he went out to, he ultimately made his way up to Cincinnati, and I believe he's buried in the Cincinnati Cemetery, in the Jewish Cemetery in Cincinnati. Okay, so that is the Shita of Rabbi Bernard Ilway. And similar Shita was held by Rabbi Maris Jacob Rafal. Who is he? He was the rabbi of B'nai Yeshurun in New York. B'nai Yeshurun was the breakaway from Spanish and Portuguese. Spanish and Portuguese were Sephardic, while the B'nai Yeshurun was for the people of German and Polish descent that came to America. They started their own synagogue. It still exists today, B'nai Yeshurun. It exists on the Upper West Side, like 80 in the 80s someplace. It was at that time an Orthodox synagogue. That's what it came down. It became conservative. The rabbi then became one of the founders of Jewish Theological Seminary. So I believe it exists today. I'm not even sure it's affiliated anymore. It was one of the first affiliated synagogues on the Wikipedia page of the conservative movement. But I'm not sure if it's actually affiliated one way or another today. But anyways, it still exists. And he also says a similar idea as Bernard Ilway. He says, "My friends, I am sorry to find that I am delivering a pro-slavery discourse." Right? I'm sorry to say that I have to be pro-slavery. I have no friend in slavery in the abstract and still less friendly to the practical work of slavery, but I stand here as a teacher in Israel, not to place fear my own feelings and opinions, but to propound to you the word of God, the Bible view of slavery, with a due sense of my responsibility. I'm to state to you the truth and nothing but the truth, however unpalatable or unpopular the truth may be." And he was in New York, right? So New York was obviously a pro-abolitionist, and he he said, "Look, I can't. You could be pro-abolitionist, but I can't say that that's going to be the position of the Torah." Similar, he actually quotes here in this article from the Reverend Sabato Moraes, who was the Chazan of Mikveh Israel, who also gave a similar discussion. He was actually one of the real founders of Jewish Theological Seminary, an interesting guy. And he also has the rabbi here from the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue, all sort of saying the same thing.
Just back to Bruce's point, slavery,
academic Torah equivalency.
Thank you.
The slavery in the Torah, which was really a means for people to, that voluntarily, in many cases, either avoid prison or to, pay debt, et cetera, they do it on their own.
So
taking people out of their native land by force and shipping them.
So that's an interesting distinction.
Did any of these guys bring this up?
Right. I don't think they brought it up. They didn't bring it up. They said, "Look, I'm passing the Shiloh. Slavery okay? Is it not okay? It's in the Bible. It's going to be okay." Now you happen to be of that. You perhaps have a chinuch that has taught you that. What do you mean? Jewish slavery is obviously okay. That distinction, that ha'ara, is a chiddush. Who says? Who says? Yes, I know the Eved Ivri was taken, we perceive it as, he shows up in Beis Din, and Beis Din says, you owe some gelt. And the guy says, "Well, I'm sorry, I don't have." "Oh, it's okay. Don't worry, you'll be by these people a couple of years and it'll all work out."
Yeah.
Really? Are you sure that that's the case?
Well, it's in the Gemara. It's in the...
Yes, the Gemara does have a line. The Gemara does have a line along those lines where it says that it's better not to enslave. One who acquires a slave acquires a master for themselves. But does that mean that that's the way it was observed?
Alright,
maybe. In their works, they do not make...
See between what they were going on was by saying that slavery was okay per Torah, it was the same kind of slavery as they were dealing with in their moment when they had to give these sermons and give this opinion.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have
that distinction. Now
they didn't make a distinction.
They did not.
Didn't learn,
I don't know.
They obviously didn't learn Mefarshim that didn't exist for another 100 years that pointed out that distinction.
The distinction wasn't pointed out many centuries before.
That took it to the point that you're taking it as, clearly there's a difference. I'm not sure if it was so clear that there's a difference.
But
Now, it could be those came along, that ha'ara came along. And you'd be like, oh, hey, wait a sec. You know, if you investigate, you look here, you look there, you see that there's different things if you learn the Talmud, etc. But if you learn Tanakh, you don't see. You just learn through our Parsha. It's not so clear what the difference is. And not only that, we also have Eved Kananim. Those yes. Halachas are by Eved Ivri. What about Eved Kanani? An Eved Kanani where you are pretty much taking people against their will, forcing them to be Jewish even. Forcing them to change religion. So
that's I think a better.
Okay, fine. All right, I didn't. If that will allow me to move on, so then accept that one instead. So there was somebody else out there. There was somebody out. Now this is when I gave this in the Beth HaMedrash. This got me into trouble. But there is another person out there. His name goes by David Einhorn. David Einhorn was a clearly Reform rabbi. In fact, a radical Reform rabbi that lived during the time. I believe he was in Baltimore when he issued this statement at the time in the same place. You know, not the same place, but along with Rabbi Illouay. David Einhorn is my Chav and I's Shatkin. We were friend of mine named David Einhorn. He has the same name. As well as like a owner of the Mets or someone who wanted to own the Mets was also, I think, also has a name, David Einhorn.
He's the owner of one of the baseball.
I think he wanted to own the Mets and it didn't let him. All right, anyways, so there was somebody named David Einhorn. He was one of the original one of the radical Reform rabbis of America during that time. And he looked at it and said, and he actually takes on this Rabbi Rafal. Now, I don't believe it was a sermon that day. It was a sermon later on where he takes on Rabbi Rafal and raises the questions that you're raising. I'll take a look here. So, he says that just because the Torah might advocate it, who says that that's something? I mean, it's just because it approves it. There's a difference between approving and justifying and favoring it, right? The Torah has it. It's in the Torah. Does that mean the Torah wants one to have slaves? He says, so his position is the Torah doesn't want it. That it was something that is in the Torah. The Torah has it. It exists within the Torah as a law. But not something that the Torah is advocating that one goes ahead and does. And he says,
so it's something that's conditional. If you have slaves.
If you have one, then you have it.
This is your procedure, practice, whatever.
Right. So he said, so you're going to say, Rabbi Rafal says, whatever the Bible concedes is morally good, and I dare not say it is a sin with my sophistry. Very well. Then we beg Mr. Rafal to instruct us with the following. According to Deuteronomy, it is directed, a man possessing two wives and loving one and hating the other, both bearing him sons. The firstborn belongs to the hated wife, dares not transfer the right of the firstborn, etc. Can we conceive of a more decided recognition of polygamy or at least bigamy? Right? Does that mean that the Torah wants us to have two wives? Does it make any difference whether a hated one whose son is granted the rights of the firstborn has been wedded before or after the loved one? Is the justification of an institution, the morality of which Dr. Rafal will scarcely deny, whose propagation Rabbeinu Gershom sought to check through a ban, not here affirmed in the most positive manner? Right? Even the rabbis teach the law permits the marriage of prisoners only of necessity. Divorce is also divorce is the same thing. The Torah tells us how to divorce people. Does that mean the Torah wants us to divorce people? Or it just provides a method for it to take place? So therefore, he takes on also. I mean, he's a Reform rabbi. He doesn't care. Right? So he's taking on Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov as well, right? You infidels, our rabbis claim with such fervor that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Job are not slave owners. This is certainly true, but it is just as true that among these pious and enlightened men, there were some who had more than one wife, and it is difficult to perceive why they should serve as models to us as slaveholders more so than in this respect. Right, so he's saying, just because it existed, it doesn't mean that we necessarily take our moral guidance from that. So part of that is, I could hear the argument. On the other hand, you see where this is going. Right, what he's saying is that just because the Torah provides morality, we should be more moral. And just because the Torah said this, and that might go against what the New York Times says, the New York Times is much more advanced than the Torah. So therefore, we should be following the New York Times when there's a machlokas, New York Times and the Torah. Well, New York Times is now at a higher level of morality, chas v'shalom, right? So let's take that over what it says in the Torah, right? So it's a very slippery slope where he's going. But is he right? Is he right? Is there room to say what he's saying here? So probably yes.
It seems to me that the Torah frowns upon
right. So I believe the honest answer is that going now almost 200 years later after that, we probably seem to accept at least this writing of David Einhorn. David Einhorn was a Reform rabbi, clearly against Torah mitzvahs, probably was not Shomer Torah mitzvahs in any way whatsoever, from what I understand. But in terms of his defense here, it's I believe it holds water. He, in his article in Mr. Goldstein, I forget his name, where was it? Yaakov Weinstein's article. So he points out two arguments that deal with slavery nowadays. One he quotes from Rav Elchanan Semet, who was a Rebbe in Gush Etzion, where he discusses, takes the attitude towards slavery of that, what Bruce is trying to argue vehemently, that the slavery that's described in the in the South, in the Confederacy before the Civil War, is not to be compared with the slavery that is employed by the Torah. That the Torah, in fact, yes, it's true that the Torah may have had it, but the Torah has so many halachos regulating how it's going to be that it ends up being not very much slavery at all. Yes, there is a slavery aspect that you can't leave, that you can't run away, but the morality of treating other people with respect is certainly there when it comes to the Torah view of slavery. Both Eved Ivri as well as Eved Kanani, I think we would make that argument. Now, Eved Ivri is treated much better than Eved Kanani, but still, the recognition of the humanity of Eved Kanani is still there. Right? The halachos of slavery, in terms of freeing them if you damage them, things like that, so that would obviously that would not exist in the Confederacy South, and that it did not exist in slavery throughout the ages.
Once they paid off their debt, they were free to leave. The Shemitah,
yes, right, right. All of those are in
the way they were.
Okay, so all of those are indications that there's a difference. Yes,
right.
Yes, so you're right all along, Chris.
Despite the
Then there is also a article. There's an article from Rav Nachum Eliezer Rabinowitz, who I believe is the Rav in Maale Adumim. Article is available. You can find it online. The article is entitled "The Way of the Torah." The Way of Torah. Where he points out that the idea for the Torah to come along back then and say slavery is hereby abolished, is hereby prohibited, would be such a, was not something that the people are ready for, so to speak. Now, this is much more controversial and slides into the David Einhorn territory. But that was something that was not, you couldn't get around it. That just an individual training proceeds step, where did I put it? Just as an individual's training proceeds step by step until he attains his full spiritual stature, the history of Israel as a whole comprises periods that correspond to various stages of human maturation. In each of them, the Torah serves as a guide and regulator, for the Torah was given not to one generation alone, but to all generations. The Torah thus encompasses guidance for each stage of development along the way, as well as instruction on how God is to be served, to be perfected man in the generation that has attained full wisdom. The Torah revolutionized the institution of slavery. Some fundamental principles cannot be violated, and they set a floor that prevented descent to the vile conduct of the nations. I mean, the Torah's perspective on slavery was a big chiddush, right? It was a big deal that, for example, in contrast to the laws of other nations, the slave soul did not become the master's property, but remained that of, the master of all. If a man strike his slave in the maidservant with a rod, causes death, the death shall be avenged. The slave may be given over to labor for the master, but the Torah remains concerned about the slave soul as well. The Sabbath is sacred not only for the master, but for the slave as well. On the seventh, you'll get rest, referring to the master, but also to the included in the Aseres HaDibros is, right, the Eved. The Eved is also going to get Shabbos off. You're obligated to provide rest even for the animals that work for you, and the Sabbath affords slave more than rest and respite from enslavement. In this case, scripture says, be refreshed, and you're obligated to allow them to keep. The sages direct so much attention to remedial legislation related to slaves and the doctrine of equality, so penetrated the national consciousness that these attitudes eventually became characteristic of Judaism, and oppressive regimes attempted to uproot them. And he actually tells the story that the Gemara describes, that they once arrested a Jew and charged him with freeing a slave. And they said, how could you free a slave? In the Gemara, it's Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Daf Yutes, I believe. Five offenses. What are the charges? Why did you emancipate your slave? Rashi comments there that the Romans had prohibited freeing slaves because the practice was a Jewish religious precept. Meaning you see that the Jews were already advanced to the other people that existed then. And that should allow for continued development. Now this is a big, this is a very questionable thing. What do you mean, moral development? That then raises all sorts of questions as to the veracity of Torah. B'zman hazeh. So I believe one major caveat has to always be thrown into these discussions, is that where is the counterforce coming from? Is the counterforce coming from the New York Times? Is the counterforce coming from other challenges of various parties that might exist, that you're immoral for this thing, or Jewish values require the following, or is the counterforce coming from the Torah itself? Right, the Torah itself tells us that one has to treat slaves kindly. The Torah itself limits the owner, the ability to own slaves for long periods of time. And therefore, because the Torah itself limits that, the Torah itself gives us an attitude towards that that could then afford us the ability to, even though the Torah talks about the ownership of slaves, to be able to say that it's a very morally challenging thing to permit it to permit in those days. By the way, David Einhorn, after this speech, was chased out of Baltimore by an angry mob. By a mob. He was threatened with his life, and he left Baltimore, and he also ended up moving to Cincinnati. So anyways, that's some perspectives on the Torah's view of slavery, and we'll move on to something else in the upcoming days.